Start looking for each other's greatness and stop just focusing on the negative.
I'm thrilled today to welcome Dwayne Cummings to Culture Matters. I am just super happy to have you, Dwayne. You and I have been good friends now for quite some time. Dwayne is an author, speaker, consultant, internationally recognized as a sensational person, but also has two books out, The Sensational Leader and The Sensational Salesman. Dwayne, welcome to Culture Matters. Just great to have you, man.
Yeah, thanks so much, my brother. It's an honor, and I am humbled to be on Cultural Matters. This is awesome.
Yeah, so you have been very instrumental in my life because you were the person who really encouraged me to kind of move beyond just teaching and talking about Hispanics to really talking more about culture, cultural mastery skills, more internationally, much broader. I want to thank you for that. So how have you been? How you doing? You're in Oklahoma City right now, right?
I am today. It is 20 degrees outside. They got this cold snap coming through. We're here visiting family and hanging out. And yeah, I mean, I've had a front row seat to you for the last decade watching you do your magic. And it's been very impressive and very inspiring to see you take what was already, you know, a great idea and great content and spread it beyond Latinos and Latinas and take it to the rest of the world. So congratulations. Kudos to you.
Oh, man. Thank you. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. It's the truth, man. I mean, you said I kind of encouraged you. I'm glad you looked at it as encouragement because I thought I was, you know, just nagging on you all the time.
Well, sometimes you pissed me off.
I'm sure. Yeah. that's the truth, I'm sure. That's the truth with most people that have known each other for a decade, right?
Yes. But I will say this, you know, I think that the moment where you kind of gained my heart and my friendship, like really, right, was at a speech that we did together in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know if you remember this or not. I think it was for... Was it for the roofing industry or?
Oh, that was one I produced and you came for. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you actually speak there or did you just, you produced
it?
No,
I just produced it. You were one of the people on the lineup that we brought in. Right.
So I walked into my hotel room and Dwayne and I had known each other, not too long before that, maybe a year or so before that. But I think he had heard me speak one time I think it was a Best of Success.
In Florida. Yeah, we both spoke at Best of Success in Florida. That's where I saw you the first time.
Right. And so for those who don't know, Best of Success is one of, or perhaps the most important conferences in the roofing industry outside of International Roofing Expo, right? And yeah. It's a great conference. But anyway, so Dwayne invites me up to speak at this conference that he was putting on. And I walked into the hotel room and there in the room is draped a Puerto Rican flag on my bed. And Dwayne, literally, I started to cry.
Oh, wow.
And it was really emotional for me because it was like, here's this American guy who just heard me speak one time and we've had a few conversations who gets me so deeply culturally that you just knew how meaningful that would be to me, right? And I think that was one of the most beautiful gestures that someone has ever given to me from a professional standpoint. So that's always just resonated with me. I still have that flag. And
wow.
So
thank you. And it's been all downhill for me since then, right?
I don't think so. I love you like a brother.
Yeah, man. I love you too.
You're amazing. So
that's very kind. I'll accept your gift today.
You wrote these two books, these two great books, The Sensational Salesman and The Sensational Leader. But this isn't one of those conversations like to trump up what we've written or what we've spoken on. This is a conversation about culture.
Right.
And a lot of people know you, but I don't know that a lot of people know that you were not born in the United States. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, true. So I was born on a military base, actually off of the military base in Augsburg, Germany. And the guy that's listed on my birth certificate, I still to this day don't know who my father is, but the guy that's listed on my birth certificate was serving in the U.S. Army and we were there. And so we were there for a few years and, you know, I don't really claim anything, but it was interesting because as I approached 18, I had only a German birth certificate and I had to declare non-German citizenship. I had to make sure I could declare U.S. citizenship. They didn't allow me to do dual, or if I did do dual, I had to serve in their military. So, it was pretty interesting. And I never, I mean, I know very little German. We've been back several times. I love the country. I don't claim to be German, but yeah. So I guess even though I always labeled myself or felt like I was an American, et cetera, there was this little part of me in the back of my head that was always, you know, I guess I felt somewhat foreign sometimes, you know, just because I was born on foreign soil. Yeah.
Wow. Man, that's fascinating. But you served in the military as well, right?
I did. Yeah, and I'd like to say I followed my father's footsteps, but that's not really the case, right? But yeah, and so first active duty station was 101st Airborne, and then I had the opportunity to go serve in Korea in the 2nd ID. And I spent about a year and a half at the DMZ. And that was real interesting because I was in a very small unit, surrounded by just it was an engineer unit, but divers. And so we were really around Koreans almost solely all the time. Hence why I, you know, Hangul Machareo, learned to speak Korean and really, really got probably a deeper love for foreign cultures there. Because, you know, I got to watch kids around me growing up or walking by me every day going to school, or the farmer going out working in his fields, or somebody milking a cow, or, you know, just all that. And you have this longing for home, and yet you have a deep respect for somebody else's way of life. And so we have a very American-centric view most of the time in the United States. You know, our way is the best way, and we're the most advanced. And because a lot of people, when they travel, they just kind of travel to go see the sights, right? I'm going to London to see Big Ben, or I'm going to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower. But when you get immersed in other cultures like that, for instance, you have a different appreciation and fondness for people, just people, different people. That's it.
What did you learn about the Koreans that you can teach us here, that we can?
Oh, wow. Loyal family. So loyal sometimes that, you know, just like you've seen stereotypically and straight out of casting, the kids do what the parents say, even if they hate it, don't want to do it. Very disciplined. You know, they went from being in the middle of a worn, torn, nothing left kind of thing to one of the fastest growing, you know, I think they became number 8 or number 7 economies in the world, you know, by the 90s. That's a pretty huge turnaround from, you know, a war in the 50s.
Right.
That comes from discipline. And hence their national sport of Taekwondo is about discipline. And yeah, they're very stern, very literally, you know, strong jawed disciplinarians that when they put their mind to something, they get it done.
So we were allies with the Koreans in the Korean War. And how did that continue to shape the relationships between the Koreans and the Americans? And what are those relationships like today? Perhaps from your standpoint, from a personal standpoint, but even perhaps more on a geopolitical standpoint.
Yeah. So Korea is a peninsula, and the Chinese and North Koreans had pushed and squeezed the Koreans down in, and America was there to help and kind of push back the tide and push them up to the 38th parallel and fight them back. And we still have a peace treaty to this day. And so what that fostered in Korean people was this ridiculous deep love for Americans, right? Because we basically saved South Korea from being pushed off the map. That's how it would literally be. You know, there it was really cool because you were just treated almost like a hero all the time. The local people were very grateful for you being there. You know, you're looking across at North Korean and weapons, and they know that it is you that is standing between those people and their future, good or bad. And even to this day, you know, when we'll go out to eat at a Korean restaurant, or I'll hear somebody speaking in a mall and I'll say something to them, and then we start talking about why I was there. And 30 plus years later, they will thank me for going to their country and for helping them and for their for my service. So, you know, there's this sense of purpose, you know, that what I did contributed to an overall bigger picture, right? And carried on a culture, because there's a lot of times where, you know, wars cause cultures to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Yes.
So their traditions, their history, their food, their music, their all the things that you know to be cultural markers and things that are important in culture. I feel like I had a very, very small, like my minuscule hand in keeping that going, right? And so when you look at it from a macro point of view, wow, if that's all I did in my life was keep a culture going.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a kind of a big deal. So I guess I'm a big deal, Ricardo. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
No,
you know that. That's absolutely the case. No, it's true. What's interesting to me, just beneath this, you keep referring to the Koreans, but you don't say the South Koreans. Do they see themselves, and do you see them as like the Koreans, like the real Koreans, and the North Koreans not as Koreans? And maybe this is a silly question, but it's just
No, it's a fantastic question. So a lot of people might be able to relate it to Germans, right? So there was a war there where there's a wall between East and West, Germany and in Berlin. And there was a mentality that East Germans, were communists and West Germans were not. And so they were different, but yet Germans felt like they were Germans because there was families that were stuck on both sides of the wall, right? And the same thing in Korea, there were families that were just abruptly split apart. And they speak the same language, they eat the same foods, and well, if the North Koreans are getting a chance to eat. And so the North Koreans were kind of, they're under a dictatorship. So in my mind, they're still Koreans. They just happen to be, oppressed. And South Koreans, they have family members that are in North Korea that they're always hoping would someday get out and they'll be reunited with. So it is interesting if you see a Korean person, like it happens to me all the time. And I'll say, where are you? I know you speak Korean. Where are you from? And they'll say a lot of times, South Korea. And then I'll be like, yeah. And I almost want to say like, yeah, I get it. Because if you're from North Korea, you're probably not here. right. And then they'll tell me what city. So yeah, it's real interesting. I think Koreans see themselves as Koreans. And it's unfortunate that their brothers and sisters and family members and cousins and all that stuff have been stuck in an oppressed regime society.
From your viewpoint, right? Because you've traveled the world and you've been in leadership positions of great importance. Where and when does oppression start and why?
Well, it's that whole deal about power and influence, right? And so people that want power for whatever reason, whether it's political gains, financial gains, they have a viewpoint. Unfortunately, a lot of leaders have a viewpoint that power means I must take something from someone else or I must control something else, which is the opposite idea of leadership that I believe in. Leadership for me is about influence and liberating someone else, right? And even more than power is force. So oppression starts when there is force applied, because with force is resistance, right? People can be powerful and liberating other people and there's not resistance, but when there's force, there's resistance. And so I think oppression starts when somebody wants something and, it's the old, I'm going to blow your light out to make mine look brighter. I'm going to take your resources. I'm going to, control your capital. I'm going to control your people. And in reality, if you want to talk about the deep-seatedness of it, I think oppression starts when you have a lack of respect for humanity, right? For your fellow man, because people, animals, whatever, should not be oppressed. They should be liberated. So the minute you oppress something, you've taken away, that individual on this planet, in my opinion.
As you view through your world travels, and I know this could be a little bit controversial, but I'm just curious as to your thinking. Where do you think America is at right now, culturally? Are we on a path that we could see that kind of oppression? Do you think we're not close to that? Do you think it's just overblown reactionary talk? What's your personal view on that?
Well, I'm going to say that if there's ever indicators out there, right, where there's smoke, there could be fire. If somebody says they're scared, you should check into it, right? So the validity of it, I always will give a keen eye, because you never know what can happen. And things can turn nowadays on a dime. The way technology is and how fast information moves and how fast populations can be swayed, their viewpoints, anything is possible. So I don't take anything off the table. Now, we are a collection and a melting pot and growing all the time. And if you couple that with the idea that everybody has a voice now, so all the different little minority packet populations, groups, they can be heard, where in the past they might not have been heard. So there is more division. And I think what happens is a lot of the younger people that I speak to, because I speak to a lot of different young people around the world and on campuses, et cetera, they have this equation that socialism means equality, meaning everybody's going to get a fair shake. Everybody gets the same opportunities. Everybody gets the same amount of food. Everybody gets access to healthcare. They don't really see what a true socialist society looks like, lives like, smells like, breathes like, and how it functions. And so my hope is that we get a little more education with people on both sides of the coin and go like, okay, this is where we're living now in a supposedly democratic capitalist society. And here is, you used Venezuela, here is what a real socialist population lives like, how they, the trials that they face and struggles and all that. This is what you will face. Is that really what you want for your future. And I think when people are given real good views into how life is, they're probably going to be pretty happy with where we're at right now and may not want to make such a drastic change. We should always be tweaking, but man, that's a pretty crazy jump. And so that there's that old phrase too, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Right.
If you look at countries that made that move and went to socialism, tell me one where, you know, people are happy and one where education is high and one where, okay, there's going to be some people that are going to refer to Scandinavian countries or whatever. It's just it is a different culture. And that's why culture matters is so important. Because if you go there, and we do, and we go and we stay for weeks at a time, sometimes months at a time in different countries, there is a different level of, you know, want and achievement and goal setting. And
a group called YouGov recently did a poll on this subject. And the result of the poll was that 70% of millennials said that they were extremely likely or somewhat likely to vote socialist in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And so, you know, if you look at the greatest generation ever and boomers and the decline in that age population and the fact that the millennial population, if you, you know, want to label that bracket, is going to be the largest very soon. Well, then it's obvious that if they get out and vote, they are going to swing the pendulum whatever way they want to swing it. They are now in charge of the direction of our future and our culture.
So you've traveled the world. Tell me a few of the countries you've been to, because you mentioned a little bit ago that you've gone to countries and spent a month or so. Where have you been and what different countries have you done that in?
Well, I guess there's like 160 something countries now, depends on who's taken over, and I've been over 100 of them. And when we go, you know, we'll stay a couple of weeks, sometimes a month. We stay, you know, Greece is one of our favorite places. It's easy to get around. Right now, it's one of the cheapest places to visit the world, the history. You can get an apartment in like downtown Athens for almost nothing. So we've done that. We've got an apartment in Beijing, you know, stayed in China. And when we go, we do get to see, like, we went to the Great Wall and, you know, climb the Great Wall and stuff like that. But we typically love to get to know the true culture, right? So go where they don't speak English. Go where you're not going to see a Golden Arches, you know, or some kind of a steakhouse that you're used to, that you probably got to eat whatever's local. And they might not even have a menu. It might be whatever they're serving that day. And you have to figure things out, like the ebb and flow of that culture and how they work and how they play. You know, China was really fun because right by where we stayed, there was a local community park. And when you would go there early in the morning, it was elderly people. And they're there and they're exercising and they're hanging out and they're playing mahjong or they're playing ping pong. And then as the day went on, in the middle of the day, there was parents with kids, little kids. And then at the end of the day, there was youth. And just to see, you know, that was a pillar in the community where people spent time and hung out. You know, we've done it in Italy. Italy's a fantastic place to spend time. And those people savor life and they slow down. And every night, it doesn't matter if you're in the big cities or small towns, you know, they go for the walk and everybody's out just kind of, you know, hanging out, and they're not worried about getting somewhere. They are where they're supposed to be and they're enjoying that moment. So yeah, those are great places. And we spend a lot of time in Africa. So it's also interesting on cultures that feel like they've kind of gone through it and arrived, like older ancient cultures, they've kind of seen it, versus cultures that are trying to come up, like African countries. Everybody's still on the hustle, right? They're trying to make a dime. They got three jobs. They're, you know, they're working 20 hours a day because they're trying to come up in the world.
What's it? I've had, you know, I live in the Dominican, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a very conscious decision. And it was the decision that I don't want to get to 65 or 70 and then just go live where I want to live for 10 years while I have still good health, right?
Right.
And so I made the decision that we're going to make this work and we're going to live where we want to live, and we'll just figure out the economics and we'll figure out what to do from a professional standpoint. And I've had friends over the years who have said to me, you know, you really should live in the States, Ricardo. You can make a lot more money and you could do a lot more speeches. And I'm like, yeah. You know,
right. And that's your goal. Right?
And, you know, and I think you just kind of look for ways, like, how can I have influence? And for me, it's through writing and this kind of thing and very selected speeches. But at the same time, like you say with the Italians, actually enjoy life. And right. And maybe America will kind of find its way along those lines. And maybe that's the pull culturally from millennials and perhaps now from Gen Z as we move into that, where people are going, you know, I saw my parents just bust their asses, you know, and they worked and they worked and they worked. And you just mentioned, you know, I don't want to be your son said, I don't want to be on the third divorce. Right. And maybe, Dwayne, I don't know this. Maybe it's not really about socialism. Maybe it's just a rejection of that culture that is all about materialism.
Yeah, that's 100%. What I was saying earlier is they need just to get more education. I don't think they're trying to embrace socialism as a, you know, a way of life. I think they are just trying to reject, as you just said, you know, the chasing of the dollar, right? What it does to you. Anymore now in my life, before I try to imbue my own beliefs on someone else about what's good for them, I try to truly understand what's motivating them, inspiring them. Why are they making the choices they're making? Because maybe they actually have something better to offer me. And so, for instance, for you, I've always been a champion of where you live, right? Like, be you, do you, be happy, because that's one thing you just can't buy. People think you can buy happiness. Happiness is an outcome to an activity. What you have is joy, right? Yeah. So you've even got better than happiness. You've got joy.
Plus, so. I have the ocean and the mountains right behind me.
Right.
80 degrees right now, and you're at 10, you know?
Right. And As you know, we had a place like down by South Padre for the last couple of years, and I'm really missing that right now. The largest military on the planet, the standard for currency and, you know, that kind of thing was England, right? So they had the most influence. They had, you know, colonies all over the world. Their military was the mightiest. The pound was what everything was after. Well, England's still around. And they're still, you know, doing well. And they're still, you know, well, it depends on who you talk to about Brexit. But so there's always going to be a place for us. Our place might just be different. And if you look at the next big labor forces or next places where you can move or monopolize. So Africa is one, right? But there's this, again, there's a difference in culture. There are certain places in Africa where, you know, Nigeria, those people are hustlers and they're trying to come up. There are other places where, look, they don't want to change, and that's okay. India is another great place. There's over a billion people in India.
Yeah.
But man, you know, their cricket's pretty important. And, you know, there's certain things that are, you know, their family and certain religious aspects and certain beliefs that are just more important, that they're not going to compromise. They're not going to give those up as a culture just to go be the world power, right?
I remember when I was interviewed, Steve Cockrum, who you know.
Oh, yeah.
When we did the Culture Matters interview, I think the first thing I said to him was, just tell me why the British are such amazing colonizers, you know, because they were like literally historically the British out of the, I think there are 201 countries represented in the United Nations, but the British at one point either invaded or colonized 179 of them.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what his answer is, but it's probably going to be something like it's because they're gentlemen, right? Because they're so polite, right?
I forget what he said. I have to go back and listen to that interview, but something along the lines of I know what he said. Because we're Great Britain. That's
what yeah. That sounds like Steve. go ahead, sir.
I want to switch to another topic, sports.
Mm, yeah.
Because you are a Hall of Fame soccer coach, if I am correct about that. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
Yes.
You're the third. You might be the three of the people that know that.
So now a whole lot more people know that. So, and my interest is that, of course, soccer is an international game. It's the most popular game in the world, the most attended game in the world. So as a coach, you must have coached a lot of athletes from different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn as a coach coaching athletes literally from all over the world?
Well, thank you for this question, because I think it's one of the most important things that shaped who I am today as a leader in business and all the things that I do to have the opportunity that I had. So I coached youth, high school, college, pro, but I coached college last. And when I coached at an NAI school that we had the ability to bring in players from all over the world. And there wasn't an age restriction like there is in the NCAA. So I actually One of the reasons I have an affiliation with Africa is I had some great African players. That, like a couple of them, you could be them on FIFA if you play Nintendo, right? I had players from Latin America and Europe and, you know, even a couple from Asia, but I got the best of the best. And I thought, originally, I thought, man, if you just get the best players, then you're going to have the best team. And that's when I really started understanding culture, because there were underlying issues that Africans were not respected by Europeans. Like, you get them into preseason and a guy from, you know, England or, you know, Scotland or someplace like that, they have a belief about Africans. They also have a belief maybe about Latin Americans. And then even in Latin America, South or Central America, you know, Brazilians don't dig El Salvadorians, and El Salvadorians don't want to hang out with Mexicans, and Guatemalans don't like Hondurans, or they just don't have, right? So you better start understanding everybody's microculture. And because that's how you're going to make your macro culture, and you're going to have to make it work. And so, you know, we changed our preseason, and we would do little things like you really needed to get to know your teammates. So they would make the food of their country and serve it to the other team members. And sometimes people liked it, sometimes they didn't. They would tell the stories of the most important things, what they valued as they were growing up, why they did what they did, what their family's hopes and dreams were. Because then you start, you know, as you know, you begin to get an education about somebody else, and you can have some empathy, and, you know, then you can become enthusiastic. You can start getting through those cultural stages that you talked about. So we talked about this a long time ago when you were going to write the book, that I felt like I lived your book by accident before I needed to. And so that's why for me, Six Stages of Cultural Mastery was so important for you to get out to people, because we went on to win championships and, you know, set records and stay in the top 10 for years, whatever it was. And I can only attribute that to creating a culture of everybody's individual microcultures, where excellence was the standard, empathy was important, where love and enthusiasm for other cultures was important, where not just tolerance, because no one wants to be tolerated, right? But real love for the differences. So what people were bringing. And so then if you look at soccer as a whole, when we started teaching this, we actually started teaching some sport culture classes, because, you know, like Brazilians are very flamboyant and enthusiastic, and goalkeepers want to juggle and they want to go try to score goals and do crazy stuff. They love samba. They love carnival. That's the way they live their life. They have this, you know, fervor. Germans are very precise. You know, they're watchmakers, and they make the way they play soccer is very precise. Latin Americans in the real warm cultures, they play hard bursts and then kind of hang out and relax and all that. And if you think about whether they take siesta, work real hard, and then they relax and have fun.
Right.
So when people started understanding that everybody's the way they are because of the culture they come from, and now how do we take the best of each one of those cultures and marry that to create our own culture? That's when magic happened. And so then now it's just, you know, kind of overlaying that formula in business, you know, or in nonprofit work that we do or whatever it is, and just start looking for each other's greatness and stop just focusing on the negative.
That's beautiful, man.
Thanks. And I said it three times. I don't usually stutter, but it stopped me in my tracks, because that was one of the most impactful moments of my life in understanding people. And because I've made all those relationships with players from all over the world, that's why we love to go places. And I have a fervor for different cultures. And I really like to, you know, get under the fabric.
A lot of lessons there.
Yeah.
I would love to have another conversation down the road about the blending of multiple cultures together in corporate environments, organizations, because we have the diversity and inclusion movement, but we're a lot stronger on the diversity part than we are actually on the inclusion part. And we're certainly far away from really leveraging the greatness of everyone, right? And so that'd be a great discussion, Dwayne. We just can't have it today. It'd be probably beyond this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that whole inclusion thing is just because it takes time and effort and energy to include people. And we are such a fast society right now that we don't even stop to say hi, let alone Right. Where you're from. So,
and it also takes a good deal of skill, because you mentioned it in what you just said, and that was understanding the microcultures. Mm-hmm. There is a difference between a Guatemalan and a person from El Salvador. There's a difference between a Puerto Rican and a Dominican. There's a difference between a Nigerian and a Kenyan.
100%, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and even, you know, look in the States, there's a difference between somebody from the South and somebody from the Northeast.
Absolutely. You know, Boston and Birmingham are very different places.
Yeah, yeah.
And, and it's easy. And we kind of fall into this because those are Hispanics, right?
Yeah.
And those are African-Americans and those are Asians. Well, there's a whole lot of difference between a lot of different people from Asia. So Koreans are not Taiwanese people and they're not Chinese people and they're not Japanese people. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
So I think your comment there about the getting that deeper understanding of the microcultures is a really important lesson for people. And I think very few people take the time to do so.
Yeah. And I think very few people start with the idea that the number one culture is our human race. That's just it. I mean, that's the bedrock of culture, right? Is we're humans. And so people skip that layer altogether most of the time. And they actually dehumanize each other and they, you know, are just brutal to each other.
Last question for this conversation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm honored.
The recent challenge that the NBA has had with the tweet from the general manager from the Houston Rockets about Hong Kong and the protest in Hong Kong and the NBA's relationship with China. And then, of course, LeBron James getting involved in that and Adam Silver making a statement on this, the NBA commissioner. What's your viewpoint on that? I mean, because you have so many moving cultural parts, so many different levels of interest there. And I would just be curious as a leader and as a person who also really deeply understands the world of sport, what's your take on that whole thing that the NBA has been going through with China and Hong Kong and with their own figures?
Well, it's interesting for one because of, again, the social media aspect, right? So once you tweet something, you could try to delete it, but it's always going to be there. So people don't always filter what they're going to say, and maybe they shouldn't have to filter what they're going to say, but information gets out there quickly. And more importantly, opinions get out there quickly and people's beliefs. And now in our time of history, no one's afraid to tell you where they stand and what they believe and what they're down for, right? But everybody is coming from a different viewpoint because they have different interests. Forget about who's talking and who's doing whatever. And so sometimes people make mistakes that hurt those brands and then they don't know how to recover from them. Just like you've been around politicians that say, you know, something about tacos or whatever at the wrong time. Right. And then because everybody has a platform now, right? So the LeBron Jameses of the world, their market is the world. They are their own brand layered in an NBA brand. So they're going to do what they think is best for their brand. It might be controversial. It might not be. It might be standing for something. It might be standing up for a cause because they also might be looking at, look, I'm only going to be in the NBA for a little while longer. I'm making my money. My money's coming off endorsements. So they're going to say their piece. So everybody's coming with different motivation. That's the challenge. So as a leader, it's kind of like negotiating. If you're really good at what you do, you set everybody down, all the parties that might be involved. You gain clarity of why we're doing what we're doing. And then you explain to people, this is what we're going to do. That takes forethought and it takes some planning. So reactionary tweets and saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, or just getting a quick press media press release out to cover what somebody else said or somebody else tweeted, those reactionary type of things just add fuel to the fire.
Yeah.
And at some point somebody has to say, okay, let's stop for a second. Let's just stop. Okay. This was the first thing that happened, whether it was right, wrong, somebody made a mistake. Let's address that. This was the next thing because I used to use this analogy with my players when I was coaching. It's one thing if you are underage and you go have a beer, you're on a college campus, you do it. It's another thing if you get in a car and drive. Then it's another thing if you get in a car and drive and have a wreck. And then if you run from the police, and then if you run somebody over, and then it's vehicular manslaughter, it just goes from bad to worse.
Yes.
And at some point, somebody has to stop and take responsibility for what they've done and say, okay, this shouldn't have happened. This should have been said. We shouldn't have made this business move. We shouldn't have done whatever. It was a mistake. Own up to it. The word being responsible is able to respond, right? Is being prepared and conscious of what you're doing. And then, you know, sometimes you have to make a decision. Am I going to do what's socially right? Like, what compass am I following? Am I following the social compass, the human compass, or am I following the dollar compass? And that's the difference in true north and magnetic north, right? So true north and magnetic north are not the same.
So what's interesting is, you said, no, this is interesting.
Oh, okay.
Because you said, are you following the social compass, right?
Right, right.
Or are you following the dollar compass? I was expecting you to say, or are you following the business compass? But you didn't, right?
Yeah, well, business, I guess business is dollar, right? So I just said it in a different way, maybe.
Well, but maybe not anymore. If you look at corporate responsibility, maybe
that's right.
Dollar is part of business.
That is right.
Responsibility is also part of business. I just thought it was interesting you said dollar, not business, because I think probably most people would have expected that business. I'm a little crazy, Dwayne. You know.
No. I believe in three-line corps. You know, social corp, B corps. And that's the thing is we have some people now that are playing business by a new game, right? So they're socially aware and they're giving back and they want to look out for the planet and so they are using the new model. And then we have the old corporate structure where it's human resources and we don't care if we have to lay off 30,000 people. We're going to hit our number to make our shareholders happy, to keep the New York Stock Exchange moving along, or whatever. And so because we're in a time where we get to see both of those competing and fighting, and we have younger people that have a belief in this new structure and older people that are holding on to this old institution, that's where you get friction.
You were talking about responsibility, the ability mm-hmm. to respond, right? Mm-hmm. We, a lot of times in our cultural mastery program, we'll talk with people about, are you going to respond or are you going to react?
100%.
It's a big difference, right?
100%. Yeah, that's why I actually said, responsible, able to respond versus just being knee jerk and, you know, not having any thought about it. Too often, and this is one of the challenges we have with our new technology and social media, is we don't understand the consequences, you know, and that's been happening for a long time. And we built this bomb that we didn't understand how it might be used, or we create things, technology rushes along and we get in a hurry to create something and then we don't realize what are those impacts. And you can't always look it forward, but man, you could take a few seconds to think about, okay, what might be three ramifications of what I'm about to do or say? And you can weigh that. That's called discernment, right? Yes. So many people nowadays don't have discernment. They don't utilize, they're not discerning.
What I'm going to say may have consequences beyond what I'm even seeing right now.
That's
and
right.
This is especially true with culture, where we have to be very careful right now, what we say or how we say, or perhaps even who we say it to. If someone wants to get in touch with you, how should they do so?
Probably the easiest way is just Dwayne, D-U-A-N-E, Cummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G-S.com. I'm honored and to call you my friend and to be on your show and to know that you are, you know, that culture does matter and you're the voice for that on this planet. So thank you.
Thank you, my brother. My guest today has been the sensational Dwayne Cummings.
Oh.
Dwayne, you are amazing. This is a great conversation. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being on Culture Matters.
I'm honored.
We'll be right back.